KUT and KUTX listeners, the stream you've connected to is going silent on April 20th. You're likely using an old bookmark, app, or link that's been around a long time. Please visit kut.org/streams. That's kut.org/streams for more information. If you're still hearing this message next time you listen, there's a form at the bottom of that page that you can fill in for help. Our websites, apps, and npr.org are updated, so you can tune in there. Thank you for listening and supporting our stations.
This is KUT
Austin.
Stop.
This is KUT Weekend for the second weekend of October 2020. Thank you for listening. I'm Nathan Bernier with KUT 90.5, the NPR station in Austin, Texas. Here's what we got for you this week. Bars allowed to reopen at 50% capacity if the county judge approves.
I mean, obviously, we're pretty angry and upset about Governor Abbott choosing to pass the buck.
How the GOP consolidated political power in Texas.
And we went out and raised that money, and then we ran ads for them and stuff. And that's how we made huge gains.
And what the economies of China and Russia have to do with otter sightings in Central Texas.
Just in the last 3 years, the complaints coming in on otters are just constant.
Those stories and more in this edition of KUT Weekend.
Only two types of businesses have not been open since July.
Let's start with another COVID-19 related announcement this week from Governor Greg Abbott.
One is river tubing operations, and the other is bars. It is time to open them up. Initially, they can open at a 50% capacity, provided that they follow the safety protocols. To ensure that these businesses open safely, and to help enforce the health protocols, these openings will be done in conjunction with county officials. County judges will be able to opt their county into these new openings beginning October the 14th, provided that they assist in enforcing the safe protocols.
So that puts this bar decision in the hands of 254 county judges across Texas, and that is not what an industry group representing bar owners wanted to hear. Michael Klein is president of the Texas Bar and Nightclub Alliance, and I asked him for his reaction.
I mean, obviously, we're pretty angry and upset about Governor Abbott choosing to pass the buck with that announcement. We had hoped for, after some smoke signals, I guess, that we'd received, that we would have much more positive news. But instead, he chose to pass the buck to 254 county judges across the state, which, are kind of devastating for, our membership, which is mostly, a lot of our membership comprises the more urban, densely populated counties in the state of Texas. And I think we've already seen overnight and, immediate reaction that the usual suspects of county judges that we all could have guessed, have all said no. And, so that's going to leave the vast, vast majority of 51% licenses, the bars and nightclubs, closed as bars and nightclubs for the foreseeable future.
Well, I know here in Travis County, the last we heard from Judge Sambisco was he was in consultation with the county attorney's office to take a closer look at it, but no final decision had been made.
Sure. And I don't mean this in any way to take this lightly, but, obviously there's not going to be any surprise on what that decision is going to be.
The counter argument is that county judges are most intimately familiar with the public health conditions in their jurisdictions and therefore might be best equipped to make that call.
Except that, as we're going to see, that, this is mostly going to be a political decision, and we don't feel like businesses across the state of Texas should be, subject to political whims of the time, and that all businesses deserve across the state equal and fair treatment. Now, look, we had hoped that there might even be a regional approach to Governor Abbott's plan, which he released yesterday. Now, I believe there are 24 distinct hospital regions in Texas. So what works for one hospital region might be different for another. And, that might be a little less partisan than just allowing 254 county judges.
We've heard from Austin Public Health's interim medical director, Mark Escott, who said he's concerned about bars reopening because when people are consuming alcohol, they may be more likely to take off their mask and speak loudly. How can bars operate safely. What do you say to public health officials who are concerned about them reopening?
Sure. Well, the first thing is after the relaxing of the definition of what constitutes a restaurant in the state of Texas, 25% of our businesses and most of the largest ones around the state are open and have been open for over a month now. And things have gone very smoothly. And we'd like to thank all the Texans around the state who have gone out. The outpouring of support and patronship has been tremendous in all four corners of the state.
Can you paint a picture of the economic situation that Texas bars and nightclubs find themselves in today? I know it's dire, but how dire?
Well, look, I'm going to try and parse these numbers out just from information that I know. So when the relaxation of the rules to reopen as a restaurant happened, we've had over the past month and a half, about 25% of 51% licenses have reopened. So that leaves 75% that haven't. So out of those, we've pulled our membership and tried to ask for reasons why people have not taken that option and reopened as a restaurant. And the most common answer is unfortunately, we're out of money and we're closed permanently, which I think would account for about 50% of those. And then the other 50% were just didn't understand or needed help in the transitioning. When you're talking about changing the fundamentals of your business plan, it presented a lot of just challenges in terms of, grasping what that meant for the actual business. And I think that's a reason why we saw some of these, businesses not reapply. Now, today, I know for a fact that the floodgates have opened again, and that I know TABC is going to be very busy processing permit applications because there were businesses that had waited to see with the announcement, when it had happened. But now that Governor Abbott didn't open a single business, obviously the other path forward is kind of the only path forward.
Michael Klein is president of the Texas Bar and Nightclub Alliance. Thanks so much, Michael.
Thank you so much. You have a great day.
County judges in Central Texas have started announcing whether or not they're going to allow bars to reopen partially next week. In Williamson County, the judge, Bill Gravel, he responded quickly. He wanted to be the first to announce it. So here's KUT's Allison Ortegon.
Judge Bill Gravel said it is time for all Williamson County businesses to be open, which includes in-person service at 50% capacity at bars and similar establishments starting October 14th. Austin establishments in the Williamson County bounds will also be open under the decision. Gravel says the reopening needs to be monitored, but he feels confident after seeing how schools and other businesses have handled reopening, and overall based his decision on trusting county residents.
We haven't stopped operating at HEB or Walmart or Costco or Home Depot and Lowe's, so I think this is something we can do together, but absolutely we'll be monitoring it.
County judges in Bastrop and Burnett counties will also allow bars to reopen next Wednesday at 50% capacity. Allison Ortegon, KUT News.
Burnett County Judge James Oakley says he came to his decision to reopen bars after speaking to the mayor of Marble Falls, where most of the bars are in Burnett County.
My general philosophy is I'm a bit of a laissez-faire type leadership and let businesses do what they want to do, but make sure that you got some good protocols in place for as much safeguard as possible.
Under the governor's minimum health standards, bars must stop serving alcohol at 11 p.m. each day. Everyone has to stay seated while eating or drinking, and people have to wear masks wherever it's not feasible to stay at least 6 feet away from others, unless it's someone from the same household. A long-awaited report detailing why the Austin Police Department closed its DNA lab in 2016 was released last week on a Friday afternoon. Perfect time to release news if you don't want to draw a lot of attention to it. We call it a Friday news dump in the news business. But this closure of the DNA lab came after the state audited that lab and found some pretty poorly trained staff and improper testing procedures. So KUT's Audrey McGlynn, she spent the weekend taking a look at that long-awaited report.
In 150 pages, consultants with the Quattrone Center in Philadelphia lay out more than 50 factors they say contributed to the lab's closure. For example, consultants write that staff were inadequately supervised and used equipment in ways it was not meant to be used. The consultants go on to recommend more than 80 things to improve operations, including who should oversee the DNA lab going forward. Working with a group of local experts, the consultants suggest three ideas: either put the lab back under APD's control, have it run by the city, or create some sort of local government corporation to run it. Since its closure, the former APD lab has been run by the state. In a letter attached to the report, city staff say no decisions will be made now. The future of the DNA lab will be part of a bigger conversation about how to change public safety in the city. This discussion's been ongoing since city council members voted this summer to cut millions from the police budget. Audrey McGlinchey, KUT News.
Austin city staff are recommending changes to a proposal that would charge developers new fees for transportation infrastructure needs when those needs are created by new homes and businesses. KUT's Samuel King reports the changes aim to ensure more equity across the city.
The new street impact fee would be based on how much more traffic a new development could potentially cause, and people who live in less dense parts of the city often drive more on average than those who live in the city's core. That would create higher fees, not only in affluent areas west of I-35, but also in historically disadvantaged areas in the Eastern Crescent. Leanne Miller with the Austin Transportation Department says staff doesn't want to penalize developers for bringing needed services to the east side.
The recommendation was to look at what would happen if we normalized the fee to account for these historic underinvestments.
So new grocery stores or financial institutions built in the Eastern Crescent would be exempt altogether. The city council is expected to hold a public hearing and possibly adopt the plan next month. Samuel King, KUT News.
Something potentially huge could happen in Texas politics in the upcoming election. Democrats have a real chance at winning control of the Texas House of Representatives. We're going to bring you a series over the next few weeks looking at what that could mean for state government. We call the series The Big Flip. So KUT's Ashley Lopez and a few other KUT reporters have been looking at the possible ramifications. Right now, we're going to lay out the history of how Republicans took control and then worked to keep it. Here's Ashley.
This would be the first time in about two decades that Republicans in Texas don't have a complete lock on every branch of government in the state. And there are a lot of reasons why Democrats think this could be the year the GOP trifecta, which is the governor's office, the state Senate, and the state House, could be broken. First, though, Andrew Weber is going to walk us through some of the recent history of Texas politics and what happened the last time control of the state government started to change from one party to another. Hey, Andrew.
Hey, Ashley.
So let's start with what we know about Texas politics now.
Right. So the conventional wisdom, as is pretty demonstrated through the last, 20 or so years, is that Texas is a red state. And I know this is something that you know pretty well.
The last time a Democrat won a statewide election of any kind was back in 1994.
Yeah, I think I've done 10 versions of that story.
Yeah, everybody has. But it's sort of all, as far as that sort of genesis of that, starts with LBJ.
LBJ, he was the, let me see if I get this right. He was the Texas senator for a while and then became vice president.
Yes, yes. And here he is at the 1960 convention.
And I do, here and now, solicit the votes of every delegate present in this room or the sound of my voice.
So he was trying to get the nomination for the presidency for the Democratic Party of the United States.
Not so successful.
Not successful at all. But the person who won that, John Fitzgerald Kennedy, picked him to be the VP. So this gave Republicans a shot at that U.S. Senate seat vacated by LBJ. And one of the people who ran for it was a guy named John Tower.
Fellow Texans. I'm John Tower, the only genuine conservative candidate for the United States Senate. I've been asked several times in my travels over the state whether or not I would have any influence with Lyndon Johnson and Sam Rayburn if I am elected. I can assure you that I would have none. But even more important, they would have no influence with me.
It's so crazy how people still run against Washington almost exactly using this language.
Right, but Tower was kind of unique because he was one of the first dudes to do this and specifically call out the Speaker of the House, who was from Texas, and the Vice President, who was also from Texas, as we've covered, LBJ. But he won, which shocked a lot of people, and it inspired a lot of Republicans to run, both on the national level and in state house races. And one of those people was a 24-year-old teacher from Midland named Tom Craddock.
I was very young, and at that point, average age of the legislature was probably at least 20 years older than it is today, okay? And there I was.
So I'm guessing he wasn't, like, totally popular.
Yeah, he was pretty much one of, I think he said, maybe two other Republicans in the state House, and it was not like it is today as far as getting bills passed.
I remember I introduced my first bill to create a district court in Midland, and basically we're like, well, Republicans don't introduce bills, you know, because there were so few of us. And so everybody thought you were kind of an odd person as a Republican and not thought of very well.
Yeah, but it didn't stay this way, obviously, right?
It didn't. And one of the big things, keep in mind this is late 60s, early 70s-ish, was a scandal called the Sharpstown Scandal.
Ooh, what's that?
It was essentially a developer from Houston was paying lawmakers for preferential treatment, which took the form of laws that benefited his developments. And this was something that a lot of Republicans rallied behind, and Democrats did as well.
I can start off by telling you this. I was a part of that group that went in after the Sharpstown scandal, and it was over 76 of us, 77 of us at that time.
Yeah, so that's Sempronia Thompson, right? She's like that OG Texas Ledge member.
Yes.
Been there for decades at this point.
A group of people that consist of both Democrats and Republicans had formed a reliance among themselves to try to vet out the crime, the corruption that they saw that was existing in the Texas legislature.
So like you heard, that sort of propelled her to run for office. And it was something that, like I said, Republicans sort of gathered around, too. And it was this weird sort of bipartisan moment of a kumbaya to make the Texas legislature more ethical and led to a lot of reform. Keep in mind, it's in 72, just before Watergate. But also, there were a handful of lawsuits against the way Texas divided up political districts. And that is another thing that helped Sempronia Thompson get into office.
The opportunity came about when... And Richard's husband, Dave Richards, won the lawsuit on single member districts. It just happened to be an area that a district was in the area where I lived, was reared, knew a lot of people, and then I just thought that I would try it out.
So those decisions benefited Republicans too, because they started grabbing state House and state Senate seats. In 1979, Bill Clements, who was a Republican, was elected governor. He was the first Republican governor at that time in modern history. Bill Clements won again in 1986. Around this time, Tom Craddock, who we talked to earlier, started trying to recruit folks to run in rural areas and raising money for folks.
You need to win a seat in Big Spring or somewhere out in the rural areas, but you couldn't raise any money to run those races. And so what I did is I went into the large cities, Houston, Dallas, and Fort Worth and that, and raised money and had a little brochure put together on who we were going to run and what races and the profile on each of those candidates. And we went out and raised that money, and then we ran ads for them and stuff. And that's how we made huge gains.
Yeah, so the idea here is like Craddock would go to sort of like rich guys in the big cities and be like, hey, adopt this politician who's running for office in this little bitty town over here. And that's how they started winning in some of these rural places. I mean, but did that work? Did that get them any power?
Yes and no. So Republicans were gaining more political power, but at the same time, Ann Richards was elected governor after Bill Clements, and she was elected in 1990. So Texas was purple-ish, and then it all kind of came to a head in 1994.
We worked hard. We ran a good race. We have done a lot of good for Texas. This is not the end of the world. It is the end of a campaign.
Right. So this is when Ann Richards lost her reelection to George W. Bush.
Right.
That was sort of the beginning of his ascendancy to later become the president.
Right. A few years after that, he would become president. And the person who took his place in the governor's mansion was Rick Perry, the longest serving governor in Texas's history. And then a few years later, Republicans took the state Senate. And then in 2002, they finally got the state House.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy that Republicans, like the last thing they were able to take was the House, whereas now it looks like the first place where Democrats can make any gains is in the Texas House.
Right, right. It's kind of like a top-down versus bottom-up situation.
That was KUT's Andrew Weber. Okay, so that was the last 20 years, but then 2018 happened. That means we have to talk about Beto O'Rourke's Senate run. Let's start at election night. I was actually in El Paso with the O'Rourke campaign, and Mose Bushell was in Austin with the Republicans. Hey, Mose.
Hey, Ashley, how you doing?
So what was that like?
Well, I was with Greg Abbott and the Republicans downtown Austin. I got some sound from it here. I'll play you a little bit of the background music.
Fun little time capsule.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, generally it was pretty upbeat. And I don't know, can I just stop that? So, I've covered a fair amount of GOP election night parties, and in Texas, they're often pretty upbeat kind of affairs, right? The Republicans usually do pretty well, at least outside of Travis County. So yeah, we had some Prince playing, and people kind of starting to get loose. There's this bar downtown. But then I noticed after a little while that the whole kind of mood shifted. And at first I wasn't even sure what was going on. You know, you're kind of scrambling around, trying to get tape, do interviews, call back to the station. But more and more people seem to be not talking, like not drinking, but looking at their cell phones instead. The way I remember it almost, it's like even the music kind of dropped. I know definitely that all the chatter of the crowd went down. People are standing there staring at their phones. And I remember asking this guy, what are you looking at? And he said that they were looking at these returns from suburban areas. I think I want to say it was like outside of Dallas. And that Beto was beating Ted Cruz in these districts that had been really like Republican strongholds, you know, for the last, you know, for recent history, I guess you could say. As you can imagine, you know, these people are starting to think, well, wait a second. If Cruz can lose these districts, he might lose this whole thing. The afterworld.
A world of never-ending happiness. Yeah. And then, like, I remember the kind of inverse situation happening in El Paso. I remember when early voting first came in, that's when numbers started looking really bad for Ted Cruz, was very early on in the night. But yeah, we know how this ends, right? Ted Cruz won. Beto O'Rourke conceded. Yeah. Did the mood at least shift, like, at that point?
The interesting thing about, you know, my memory of that night now is that it did end up, you know, kind of going the way that initially people expected it to. Cruz won. The Republicans maintained a lock on statewide offices in Texas. But that moment still stuck out in my mind, right? That whatever it was, that 20 minutes or however long it was, when there was this kind of fear that I, at least as a reporter, had never really seen the GOP... I'd never really seen expressed at a Republican election night party up until that.
Yeah, and I gotta say, there's good reason for that to be a scary time for Republicans, because yes, Beto O'Rourke lost, but that same night, Democrats flipped 2 congressional seats and 12, a whopping 12 seats in the Texas House. I wonder if that's something that, like, Republicans even, like, kind of reflected on. Did that seem to scare them, or was it all about the Beto O'Rourke race?
I mean, well, the night of, obviously, everyone's still processing the whole thing, and I didn't meet many people after they realized that Cruz had a lock on the Senate seat that necessarily wanted to talk about the kind of larger picture. But I caught up with James Dickey. He was the head of the Republican Party of Texas at that time. He no longer is. And he basically said that he thought there wasn't a lot of cause for concern for the party.
That was with all of the stars aligning about as perfectly as possible for his opposition. And so I hope that the folks who from all over the country put money into Texas trying to buy that election, I hope that they take that lesson to heart, that no, in the most perfect of scenarios, they still lost by high single digits. That is a significant rebuttal.
So anyway, that was my night.
Okay, well, thanks, Mose. Okay, so even though Beto O'Rourke lost that night, because Democrats were so excited and engaged by this very expensive, very highly watched campaign, they were able to flip these 12 House seats. And that was a very unexpectedly good night for Democrats. And Republicans have long said that it was only because of Beto O'Rourke's run, only because there was so much flowing in to that race, that Democrats even came out and they were able to win those seats, and they will not be able to do it again. They call this the Beto effect. Now, I've heard a lot of experts, particularly in the Democratic Party, say this is just flat out wrong.
Beto was a good candidate. He ran a great race.
That's Andrew Reagan with the Texas House Democratic Campaign Committee.
But we saw up and down the ballot, candidates perform better than they had historically, and that there was a lot of voter enthusiasm on the Democratic side. That's something that both in polling and in demographics in these districts has not abated.
When he said these districts, he's talking about these 9 districts in the Texas House that O'Rourke won in 2018 that didn't flip to Democrats. That is, O'Rourke won them, but like the Democrats who was running for that House seat did not win. Now Democrats say they're really gunning for those seats because they're betting this is about more than Beto O'Rourke.
It's hard to really get your finger on the rapid change that's happening in these districts because it's both younger, more diverse, and it's more college educated than the country as a whole. And we've seen that college educated voters specifically have been repelled by both Trump and the Republican Party.
Republicans like Luke Macias don't see it this way. In fact, he says he actually thinks those districts are getting more conservative. Basically, there's nothing to see here.
Republicans are going to hold on to the House because Texans do not want to move our state in the direction of the socialist policies that the Democrat Party has established as their platform moving forward.
Pollsters, by the way, aren't calling this either way. Jim Henson with the Texas Politics Project is super plugged in, and he says he doesn't have any idea whether Democrats are going to pull this off.
I think it's closer than it's been in a long time, you know, at least 10 to 15, you know, at least 10 to 15 years.
Henson says Democrats in Texas just have more momentum, more money. And yes, their voters are just more enthusiastic. Henson says Republicans also have this other thing hovering over them coming into the election. That's the pandemic and the financial crisis that is happening right along with it in Texas.
In the period of Republican hegemony in Texas, Republicans have never really faced any kind of fundamental policy challenge that they had to address or solve. They've had, frankly, a long honeymoon, and that honeymoon is now over. And they're having to do torture the marriage metaphor, but now they're getting to the, you know, the hard work part, and they don't really have much of a model for it.
Tomorrow, we'll talk more about those 2 decades that Texas Republicans ruled over a growing economy, that not even a global financial crisis scarred too badly, and how that actually led to the political reality Republicans are facing now. This is The Big Flip. I'm Ashley Lopez.
River otters have been making a comeback in Central Texas for the past few years, but this past summer, otters were spotted in a Central Texas location where they typically have not been before, the San Marcos River. KUT's Rianne Roldan reports on why the area has had an increase in otter sightings.
In a Facebook video posted on a page for the San Marcos River Foundation, what looks like a river otter pokes its head out of the water and shakes it, swimming around before diving back and under an onlooking kayaker.
Oh my God. Oh, it's coming over here. Oh wow, it's coming over here. It's going right there.
Jonah Evans is a mammalogist for Texas Parks and Wildlife. I had him watch the video, which was posted in late July, to make sure it was a river otter and not a beaver or a nutria, which are both native to the area too.
I just saw it totally otter in that one. Yeah, the way it sticks its head up and out of the water and shakes it. Oh, it's like right under, it goes right under his boat. That's so cool.
Many wondered if the sighting had anything to do with COVID-19. Since the city of San Marcos shut down all public access to the river in late June, did that allow more otters to come out and play?
I think it's unlikely to be related to COVID. I think it's more related to the fur prices going down.
Yeah, fur. It turns out the demand and the price for a single pelt of otter fur has plummeted in the past few years.
about 10 years ago, the word was that the fur prices were really high. Maybe it's even like 20 years ago now. And the reason that they were so high is that it was being driven by a demand for Chinese fur hats in the military. They had these black fur-lined hats, and apparently that was one of the driving forces for the spike in fur prices.
So I called Dan Hepker. He's been a wildlife trapper in Central Texas for more than 50 years, and today he runs a business doing predator control work for private homes and ranches.
Up until just a few years ago, I didn't have a lot of experience with otters. Just in the last 3 years, the complaints coming in on otters are just constant.
So it's safe to say he has a more nuanced perspective on these animals besides just being cute.
I call them the wolves of the waterway. I mean, they are like a pack of wolves once they get in the water, and whatever they're after, they're going to get.
Hepker confirmed it was China, along with Russia, buying up the otter fur, and that the price of the wild fur has dropped in recent years. But now that otters are being trapped less, they're becoming kind of a nuisance for some.
When otters find a good food source, they will stay there and just eat and eat and eat and eat and eat. Otters can digest their food and pass it through in a little over an hour. So they're little eating machines.
And with the increase of these eating machines in the area, wildlife experts want help figuring out just how many have moved into the neighborhood. Jonah Evans, the wildlife biologist, encouraged people to document these sightings using an app called iNaturalist. It's basically a social network for citizen scientists and biologists to upload sightings of wildlife. We look some up together.
Yeah, so there's one in here just east of San Marcos. Oh, this is a great photo. There's like a couple running otters through a field or something.
He says it's turned out to be a hugely beneficial tool for biologists like himself.
We just don't have the money and the staff to conduct a statewide river otter survey. You're right? It's just there's no way for us to pull that off. Yet with iNaturalist now, I can look at a map of the state. And I can see where otters have been seen in the last couple of years.
River parks in San Marcos are finally open again. So whether you think they're a nuisance or really cute, next time you're out on the river, keep your eye out for an otter. Rhianne Roldan, KUT News.
KUT Weekend for the second weekend of October 2020. You can subscribe to this podcast at weekend.kut.org and email any questions or comments to weekend@kut.org or just ask me on Twitter. I'm at KUT Nathan. Our theme music is by RAC. Thank you for listening. I'm Nathan Bernier with KUT 90.5 and KUT.org. ¶¶